You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Most of the world happens when I'm not in the room. That's been a guiding principle for me as I've read and heard about all sorts of things that I've never seen myself. I know some folks prefer David Hume's assumption that anything that doesn't resemble closely enough what one has witnessed directly is more likely delusion or deception than real testimony. And I know others would just as soon dismiss the experiences of folks not on the Atlantic and Pacific coasts as primitive or even worse. But I'll take Hamlet over Hume on these kinds of matters. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And although our approaches to these matters differ somewhat, I think I found an ally in Joy Vaughn's book Phenomenal Phenomena, Biblical and Multicultural Accounts of Spirits and Exorcism. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome Dr. Vaughn to the show and to talk about her research. Dr. Vaughn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The book's premise makes all kinds of sense to me. Let's invite anthropology to the chief as the chief conversation partner of biblical studies when we look at exorcism stories, rather than relying on late Enlightenment philosophies of progress to limit possible readings. In your view, what has kept academic biblical studies from dancing with this particular partner?
All right, so the way I see it, I think there are kind of two prongs of thought about why anthropological studies and New Testament studies related to this topic have maybe not crossed paths in ways that could be fruitful. And so the first one is if we go back to like pre-1900, we go through all of the time period, think diachronically between New Testament to that period, there was a big focus on the text itself and in just an inhibition for an invitation to let another discipline really help to maybe be like a lever that interprets the text. For some Christian groups, that might have even been considered heresy to do that. And so it takes some time. In the 1960s and the 1970s, we see Old Testament studies begin to partner with anthropological studies, and probably due to the analogous relationship between ancient tribal societies and other tribal societies. And so we see more traction begin at that point. And if we fast forward until today, I think there's a lot of freedom in the discipline in a variety of ways by which New Testament studies, anthropological studies can illuminate one another. And so that's a key part of my work. And so one scholar, Louise J. Lawrence, she wrote a book called Reading with Anthropology, says the scholar today has more freedom than ever to peep over disciplinary parapets. We're not existing in, silos anymore, but really a mosaic of interdisciplinary studies has been a big part of research. The second piece is what you hinted towards in the introduction to the book and also the question, and that is there are some biases perhaps related to presuppositions and influences of the Enlightenment, naturalistic worldview, everything needs a scientific explanation, and maybe even I like to think of myself as a kind person, so I don't want to like label all these things heavy-handed, but I think maybe some ethnocentric bias. The West really knows best on these matters, and we have a lot of technology and tools to which we can interpret experiences that happen. And by and large, you know, these tools are good things, but one of my theses is they're maybe not everything.
That makes a lot of good sense. And I mean, a number of those biases that emerge, you know, in sort of German style biblical studies really come under question in this book. And one of them that I found interesting and one that I really hadn't encountered, you call the principle of analogy. So tell our listeners briefly what that principle is, some figures in biblical studies that have advanced that principle, and how focusing again on anthropology might complicate an easy confidence in the principle of analogy.
Yeah, so if we go back to the principle of analogy, it was made famous by Ernst Troeltsch. And really what we have is an idea is that a way to understand the past or to think about the history is to draw analogies with the present. And, you know, one of the first risks, if we think about our complications of this, is obviously parallelomania, right? You can almost find a parallel for everything if you're looking hard enough for it. In fact, I heard one scholar say, if you're a hammer, everything you see is a nail. And so that can really complicate. Anthropology is complex. Culture is complex. And so we would resist just like simplistic kind of comparisons and lean more on, you know, cross-cultural studies to think about that. So Trelsch, follow the logic of David Hume you introduced, saying the analogy is people don't have any modern experiences of spirit possession phenomena. And so in other words, they just don't exist. And so that's a big piece that my book is resisting, to say that one anthropologist accounted that 74% of global societies have spirit possession experience. I document a lot of this experience through characteristic categories of spirit possession throughout the book. And that's a big piece of it. So I guess I could say maybe a goal is to look at cross-cultural study and see, look at the analogy, look at how it plays out in biblical, Greco-Roman, Jewish, other ancient contexts, and then how does spirit possession play out in modern contexts?
And that's a fascinating dynamic, and one of the reasons that I found this book so interesting is that in a lot of the same circles that will discount exorcism stories as primitive or as, you know, obsolete even, those same circles, you know, will use, you know, Western Christian this and that as sort of a mild cuss word, right? You're just so influenced by Augustine that you can't da 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 da. But, you know, when it comes to exorcism, you know, all of a sudden we're all 19th century Germans. So I thought it was interesting, you know, again, that this is the premise of the book, that when we talk about exorcism, we're not discounting the modern as if there were only one modern, but we're discounting, you know, basically Atlantic and Pacific coastal cultures, and that's about it. I think it's a fascinating premise. And one of the pairs of terms that I had to learn as I was reading your book is etic and emic, and I'm probably mispronouncing those, so feel free to correct that. Okay, very good, very good. Talk to our listeners just a little bit about what those two terms mean so that we can use them in the rest of our conversation.
Yeah, so I basically had that same moment you were referring to. And, you know, it's like it's possible to read in multicultural perspectives. And then on this one, it became a kind of like faux pas. Although we had some early scholars that were doing it, but my book, I trace a lot of scholars that point out a need for it. But this topic can be kind of uncomfortable. And so I don't know if that was part of the inhibition. Just for a little laugh, you know, I didn't do a lot of my reading at night.
Nice.
You know, it's just a topic that you don't really want to go to bed thinking about. But as it relates to etic and emic perspectives, I like to kind of frame this way, give an analogy or a picture in your mind. If you think of an armchair anthropologist who's sitting and interpreting culture from afar, that would be the etic perspective. So that is, you're a person who's outside of the culture, has not experienced the culture. They may look at an experience and say, well, that's simply psychosomatic or psychological. And to just be fair, sometimes things are psychosomatic or psychological. I'm not dismissing any interpretive option in my book. I think they're all very important parts of the conversation. And so we have that armchair who's sitting from afar and interpreting. And then the emic perspective is the insider's perspective. And so this is thinking about ethnographic field work and participant observation. I read one anthropologist who wanted to participate, and so she became possessed in order to better understand what the experience would be like. This would be the goal of some of those doing ethnographic research. I personally wouldn't go that far, but that's okay for them, I guess.
Very good.
But personally, that would be a bit much for me to think I would want to. So in the research, we want to be cautious. And I was really hopeful And so when you read the anthropological perspectives, I use the terminology that each group uses to respect their experience of it, to try to present it as they would from an emic perspective, and let their spiritual interpretations have kind of a light shining on them.
That makes good sense. I want to turn back to literary histories of the text that, where we encounter the most exorcism in the New Testament, namely the Synoptic Gospels and Acts. So I learned something about the history of these of biblical scholarship and the terminology we use from this book, namely that gospel did not become a term for a distinctive literary genre until pretty recently. So before modern biblical studies started using Mark 1:1 as a label for a literary genre, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus, the Messiah, so on and so forth, what kinds of literary texts were Matthew, Mark, and Luke?
Yeah, I think it was C.S. Lewis that says, the first step to understanding anything is to understand what it is. Is it a corkscrew or is it a cathedral? And I think at this point in New Testament studies, I would say a pretty large majority of scholars would conclude, along with myself, that the Gospels are ancient biographies. And so we look at the bios, the lives of, if in this case, the life of Jesus. But we would have other biographies that are contemporaneous, and then even proto-biographies that as the genre begins to develop, that would influence the shape of the genre. I teach at Asbury University. I love to teach this lesson to my students because it unlocks so much about an understanding of the Gospels. Why aren't things in a precise chronological order? Or why do we have such a large accounting of the death of Jesus and literally nothing about childhood? Well, these are ancient ways of writing biography. And so one of the great books that set a lot of conversation about ancient biography related to the Gospels is Richard Burridge's What Are the Gospels? And I would recommend this book as a starting place to begin to understand where this conversation was emerging. There is some discussion. There has been some debate about it. One of the debates is, what are the types of biographies that are contemporaneous? How many of them do we have? How do they compare and contrast to the Gospels? We would have, if you want to, would you like a few examples?
Yeah. I mean, because when I think of ancient biographies, my knowledge base tends to start with Plutarch and Suetonius, who are much later than the New Testament Gospels. So, what kinds of texts are we talking about when we talk about biographies that are contemporary with the Gospels or even predate the Gospels?
Yeah, so if you go back to some proto-biographies in the Greek Empire, you would see the incipient development of the genre. And we don't think of genre as just like a stamp or a one-size-fits-all or like a cookie cutter when we think about it. But, there is flexibility, there is shaping in genre. And so proto-biographies from the Greek Empire, you might think of Isocrates and Xenophon, Isocrates' Euagoras and Xenophon's Agesilaus, if I can say it here, or maybe even some memoirs about Socrates to go into the, the Hellenistic era. We have a development of people writing about contemporaneous people, writing about public figures particularly, which is interesting to think about because you have access to more information about public figures than you would have about private figures. We have a second century BCE fragment from Satyrus's Life of Euripides. We could think of Philo. We could think of Cornelius Nepos, Josephus, Tacitus, Lucian, Philostratus, Diogenes. So there's a good bed of contemporaneous, before, during, and after the Gospels, of literature that has really solidified the nature of what the Gospels are as biographies, ancient biographies, in New Testament scholarship. I think this is we're on a pretty firm footing when we have a look at genre.
So when we get something like the Herodotus account of Xerxes, for instance, I mean, is that a species of biography within this framework, or does it differ in important ways that make it not a biography where other texts are?
I'll think about that one. I think we would have some differences there. But at this moment, I'm not exactly sure.
No, that's all right. Because some of the texts that you bring up, I mean, for instance, Xenophon writing about Socrates, I hadn't thought of that as a biography, but it certainly has biographical features to it. So, what kinds of things mark a text as a biography?
The most simple thing, those would be more incipient forms. So they wouldn't characterize the, fuller scope of the development of the genre, but some of the characteristics of ancient biography would be obviously a focus on one person, biographical material, a large focus on the nature of the death of the person. I think about in antiquity, the death of the person defines the life. A organizing of events for showing morality or praising. So we have some development of encomium throughout the praise of characters. Sometimes I think in like Cornelius Nepos is a little too much, right? You can kind of get into like almost like a funeral oratory kind of thing. So there would be some level of kind of rise and fall in the genre. It's not like a one size fits all, but those would be some of the characteristics that would help us to understand a bit of how it does work in antiquity.
Excellent. Well, another point that emerges here has to do with the literary form of exorcism stories. So how have biblical scholars in Western Europe and North America tended to treat these analogous literary structures, and what alternative approaches do you recommend in your book?
Yeah, I love this question, and I really wanted to write more about this, but I didn't really have room. So thanks for asking the question, because I found it really fascinating when I looked at Rudolf Bultmann. So in traditional, old school form criticism approaches, he looked at the exorcism stories and recognized, basing it on the Gerasene demoniac story, that they have a certain form that develops. And so his way of interpreting this is that they began with a small piece, and then as, Jesus's disciples and so on formed them, developed them, curated them to be what they wanted them to be, they gained this form. And so that would have been the way it played out. So the form goes something like this. And as you're thinking of like, okay, this is an exorcism, or maybe you even think of the movie The Exorcist, right? You have to have certain characteristics to make it happen, right? And so let's think of that through the lens of Bultmann's characteristics. So the first thing is the meeting with the demon, and then a description of the dangerous character of whatever that is. So what's happening there? The demon then recognizes the exorcist. So if you're thinking even about the gospel accounts, you could walk through this through that. And then you have an exorcism. You have a departure of the demon, and the Gerasene demoniac story, that would be the going into the pigs, right, moment. And then there's some impression on the spectator. In that case, there was a lot of fear and loss because there just went their whole livelihood over the cliff with a bunch of demons in it. Okay. And so, for Bultmann, this would be a bit much for him to really think of it as history. Maybe even is a bit of entertainment here. And so, okay. So we have that with him. So he has this grid saying these are the parts of a story. And then I was reading what I thought was a really good book on exorcism in the gospel, is Amanda Whitmer's Jesus the Galilean Exorcist. And so I'll throw her book a plug on your show. And she noted that anthropological accounts actually recount exorcism stories in a particular form. And I went, oh, that's so fascinating. And so she has her characteristics. There are conditions in which the exorcism takes place. The demon detects the exorcist. The exorcist recognized the demon. The exorcist worked to cause the demon to give its identity, which could be the name, the character, the manner by which it would be expelled. So, you know, feed me a good bowl of soup and I'll get out, you know, this kind of thing. Use of an incantation or spell, a command to expel the demon, and then evidence. So there has to be some evidence that the demon is gone. The person feels better. One of the gospel accounts, we have the person is clothed and in their right mind again, as a powerful part of that particular story. And she said also they typically include a demon's verbal response, a statement of its name and actions, and so on. And so I thought, well, that's so interesting because they're both recognizing lists that are pretty parallel to one of them, one from looking at the Gospels, one from looking at the anthropological accounts. And so when I started to compute this and think about it, let my brain process, I really began to think, you have to have certain things in order to have an exorcism story in the first place. And so if you take Bultmann's approach, maybe there's a way you tell an exorcism story. You could even think of oral tradition or oral history to keep it together versus, oh, well, the church had to, early church created these to prove something, you know, that Jesus was an exorcist, which actually, even if New Testament scholars don't believe in spirits or that sort of thing, typically all of them will conclude that Jesus was known as an exorcist. This is a historical datum that's really accepted. As it computes and adds up to the book, looking at the emic perspectives, looking at the way people told stories and ethnographies and anthropologies, it became a goal of mine not to jump to any conclusions about the story until I listened to all of it. And also not to jump to any conclusions about the genre of what you're listening to until you hear it all. And so, you know, there are millions of claims to spirit possession experiences that could be recounted in this structure. And just because they take a certain structure or shape, I don't think we could conclude that the testimony is not a lived reality, or we could even say a historical experience for that person.
That makes good sense. And I've got a follow-up for that, because one of the things that always fascinated me about the Poetic Edda, and I realize this is not remotely in the notes, so again, if we need to go some other direction with it, that's fine. But one notable thing about the Poetic Edda is its repeated concern with Ragnarok. And it occurred to me that, you know, these are Christian monks writing down the legends of a non-Christian society. So, you know, I always wondered, I mean, you do the parts that resonate with what's already going on in the Christian realm, make it into those poems because they resonate with the poet. And the reason I bring this up is because so much of anthropology is so related to Christian missionary work. I wonder, I mean, you know, when the anthropologist wrote this down, you know, I mean, is it a sort of literary template that they've got in their minds, whether they're believers or not, because they are familiar with Matthew, Mark, and Luke and Acts, you know, so that, you know, that pattern just occurs to them as they're writing it down? Or, I mean, have anthropologists, this is my ultimate question, have they developed methods for transmitting the literary form of these stories as well as the content of them?
That's a really interesting perspective or question. And thinking about most of the experiences that I write about in the book are non-Christian experiences. So the research is interreligious. And I really wanted to do it to sort of forestall some of that potential criticism that, well, it's just Christian, so it just reflects off of the New Testament. We have a mirroring of the New Testament. So I would say a wide majority of the authors and experiences that I write about, I don't know that we would be able to track, they would be able to tell the stories of the New Testament, for instance. So, I can't say for sure, for 100% sure, but a large amount of them would be non-Christian writers writing about experiences in Hinduism or Islam or in other sorts of religious experiences. And so I was really intentional, and I tried to really, I did do Christian experiences too, because I thought we can't leave them out.
Sure.
But I didn't want to write a book about Christian experiences, which can be shocking. And maybe even some of your listeners might be thinking, well, I've never thought about the experience of exorcism in another cultural practice. You know, that looks different than, you know, a person might try to acquire as many spirits as possible rather than to expel them all. And that would be fortuitous to participate in society that way. And so it really takes a digging down. And that's why I like the emic perspectives, a digging down to see what's going on in each particular cultural experience. And then also we would have to look at the elements of syncretism too. Sometimes we get a mixing of various religious traditions that play out. But I couldn't answer with surety on the form question. I don't think so, I think is my answer.
Very good.
Give you like a,
like I said, that's not a question that occurred to me while I was reading it. Just now emerged here in the conversation, so I figured I'd pose it while it was on the mind. But you've given us a nice segue, because chapters 4 through 6 of the book present really an impressive catalog of exorcism and other spirit narratives, first from the ancient world, including the New Testament, but not limited to it, and then turning to contemporary accounts, 20th century or 19th century, 20th century, 21st century accounts of the same kind of spirit story. So let's spend some time with those, and let's start with the spirits that cause illness. You know, what are some of the formal characteristics of these stories, but also what's some of the range? I mean, where and when do we encounter stories of spirits that make people sick?
Have you ever read something or researched and thought, wow, this is, I mean, I am a Westerner, right? I grew up in Northwest Ohio. I have a very rural background. And have you, I mean, this chapter was challenging for me because I don't typically think of, wow, I'm feeling sick or have a headache. This is having a spiritual etiology or cause to it.
If someone tells me something like that, I kind of, you know, try not to be seen rolling my eyes as I reach for the aspirin.
Right, exactly. I grew up charismatic and I respect a lot, you know, I still, you know, would really relate to a lot of that, but this really challenged me is my own research, how much, and I could have written a lot more on this chapter maybe than any other chapter, but let me walk you through some of the sources of spirits that cause illness. And so you could think of going back into the Old Testament, the spirit that's tormenting Saul. If you go look in the Enochic tradition, you have evil spirits that cause plagues, illness, and infertility. If you look in the Book of Jubilees, of course, a lot of the development of the spiritual world in Judaism is in the intertestamental literature. So we have a little bit in the Old Testament, but it really fleshes out in that particular period. You have demons that cause blindness, demons that assist Mastema in killing the firstborn of Egypt. So ultimately, the worst part of illness is death, right? So we could include that. If you look in the Greco-Roman context, I won't name all the sources, but evil spirits or demons, they could be good or bad in this case. The definition broadens. You could have them causing things like epilepsy, insanity, sleepwalking, fever, that kind of thing. Of course, in the Synoptic Gospels, we have spirits that would cause muteness, closing of the mouth, closing of the ears, deafness, blindness, epileptic fits, the woman who's bent over for a long time in Luke 13. And what's interesting in all of these cases, in the Synoptic Gospels, exorcism is the named cure. So sometimes in Luke, you might have a more kind of a blurring between what is illness and what is the influence of a spirit. But when the exorcism is secure, you know, you can have a little more conclusion about what the cause was. And so when I went to the anthropological sources, I didn't know I was going to write this chapter when I started the book. I was really stumped because I read one quote that said, if you're looking through the, something like this, I paraphrase, if you're looking through the anthropological literature to find instances where spirits cause illness, that's easy. And I was like, it is? It is? Wow. That's such a surprise to my Western mind that really thinks of other explanations a long way, a lot longer of a list before I think of spiritual ones. And so cases of infertility, cases of muteness, cases of blindness, deafness. I mean, you can find all of the parallel experiences. I read about one case where the dog was sick until they got the demon removed from the spiritual experience removed. It was fascinating. And so I do document a lot of those cases in the ancient and modern context in that chapter.
Well, I want to focus in on one especially curious kind of account, and that is the account of Indian Catholics possessed by the spirit of Mary. And what immediately, occurred to me, and I'm not sure what this says about me, probably says more about me than about the story itself, is I immediately thought of Shusaku Endo's novel Silence, and where, the intrusion of Catholicism is regarded kind of as a nationalistic threat, even more than a spiritual reality. So when these Indian Catholics are possessed by the spirit of Mary, does that stand as a welcome possession? Because I know some of these possessions are welcomed by those possessed. Or, I mean, do local exorcists try to expel Mary from this person the way that a Catholic missionary might try to expel a Loa from someone in Haiti?
Yeah. So it's kind of mixed. And so in some cases, it is very welcome to be, possessed by the spirit of Mata or Mary. And it would allow one to participate in healing ministries. And so you could become maybe a localized healer who's possessed by the spirit of Mary and then participate in healing others. And that was part of what I read. Although others had seemed to have in other stories or other accounts, negative impacts on their possession by Malta, being beaten by her or so on. And so there's a variety of both positive and negative. And so it is a desirable in some instances, and particularly it seems to be a possession of women's experiences in this category. And in other cases, it didn't turn out to be quite the positive experience. Now, as related to exorcism, this is really an experience of syncretism on the basis of Hindu practice and also Roman Catholic religion that are kind of getting smashed together here. So it might depend on who you ask. If exorcism should really be done, and in the Roman Catholic Church, there's some that have really tried to ban this as, an allowable experience. And in other cases, on the other end of the spectrum, where more syncretism is permitted, it might be favored as a positive experience. So it depends on who you are in those moments. If you're a Roman Catholic official, you might have a lot more hesitancy in some cases versus not. So it seems to be, mixed on whether there should be an exorcism. It's not maybe a one size fits all question in that experience.
So listeners, I just want you to realize here for a moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, this book is just packed with these different types of spirit stories, exorcism stories. They're from all over the world. They're from a broad historical range. You really need to get out and read this book just to see the range of what's going on here. But I want to move on to another kind of story, spirits that cause violence or enhance strength. And one of the things that you mentioned is that, quote, concession requests by a demon are not uncommon in antiquity, end quote. So the New Testament stories, I imagine, our listeners will be somewhat familiar with. As we record today, yesterday's lectionary reading was actually the Gerasene demoniac story, Luke's account of it.
Yeah.
But what are some of the sources of other stories in which demons bargain with the exorcist?
Well, most of it has to do with, could you please reduce my sentence? And so you could think of that from the perspective of the Gerasene demoniac, please, make a concession to let me go into the pigs. But actually, it doesn't work for their benefit. It works for their destruction. in that particular account. And so that's where this kind of comes from. I brought another one more example from the Testament of Solomon. In that account, it's like, no matter what the demon tries to sway you with, you need to come back and do this thing. And so, you know, don't play into their misgivings. Don't play into their ability to try to twist this kind of thing. And then we could have some others where, you know, please don't throw me into the abyss. Could we have make another arrangement? Those would be more of the Greco-Roman kind of, the Jewish kind of sources there. From modern anthropological sources, it's really fascinating to see concession requests because, you know, it's really hard for to wrap my brain around it. But, you know, if you will get the spirit saying, if you will get me a warm bowl of soup, you know, we'll do this or that or the other, or this incantation or this smell or this thing, there's a wider variety of experiences in the anthropological sources that would make those concessions. And so you can kind of imagine just like a bargaining, a desire to bargain with the exorcist, or in some case, it's not even an exorcist. It's if you don't do this, maybe more of a command, then I will do this. I will, make this negative thing happen to you. You hear stories like that as well.
So, I mean, I want to turn specifically to modern accounts from, you know, beyond Christian context. I mean, you know, what are some of the modern instances of spirit-driven feats of strength that you cover in the book? Because, like I said, the range of these accounts is really what's impressive.
Yeah, so we've done illness, and then we can think about now going on to the violence kind of piece of what we could refer to as preternatural strength, or impossible contortions. You might think about people's bones bending in ways they're not supposed to go, head turning around 360.
Yeah, now I'm really thinking about the movie.
Yeah, you really are. I was hoping for that. And so we could go back, obviously, get the New Testament ones. Like the Gerasene Demonic hits a lot of these characteristics. But I got some examples, particularly from the book. So if you think of context of Asia, you have superhuman feats that are really prevalent, practiced during traditional festivals. I actually had a friend who came and spoke to one of my classes. I taught a class called Demons and Spirits one time here at Asbury, and he came and he witnessed this experience of glass eating and fire walking and cutting. And what's fascinating about these experiences is that the person doing there's typically a performance or a religious festival going on at the same time, is that there's an immunity to pain and consequence, like licking a sword, that are really interesting. So so a lot of that in Asian experience, ability to move large rocks that require multiple people to carry. And I know some of the listeners might be thinking, well, you know, if you think of like a mother, the car is on top of the child, sometimes adrenaline can even like cause, but they would not interpret it that way. They would interpret these as spiritual. So there's another good example of maybe an etic and emic kind of perspective. In Northeast India, there's a practice of possession where one man has his head spin around 180 degrees and it gets stuck in a position. Convulsions, superhuman feats are common in Haiti, violent thrashings of the body, fire eating. I interviewed one student from India here in my class, and she talked about how anytime she would go into the Christian church, her body would just shake and shake and shake and shake. And she would have this experience. She would go to the Christian church. Her mom was very high caste, and it was like, stop going there. Please stop going there. And eventually she would just shake and shake anytime she would get close to the Christian church. She eventually experienced an exorcism in the Christian church, dedicated her life to Jesus, but that was like just her body would be convulsing. In jinn possession, I wrote of a woman who experienced something pushing on her chest that was constant for her. The doctors couldn't help. The woman's son saw a very tall man next to the wall trying to choke her. She struggled with a man pushing him away, leaving pain in her hands for the following month. That was an experience of being held, a spiritual experience for her. Another woman possessed by 67 jinn spirits gave a testimony saying, "I needed six or seven men in order to stay sitting in the chair or prevent me from doing bad things." And then I've been fascinated by a Roman Catholic or American Catholic person, Adam Bly, who writes a couple of books about his experience as an exorcist in the Catholic Church. They've been really fascinating to me. And he asks, "Can demon possession really do the horrible things to the human body seen in movies?" And he says, "Yes, bodies do sometimes contort, bones may dislocate, people have caught fire spontaneously, levitation does really happen, and they have vomited bizarre things." So these were from his experience as a Roman or a Catholic exorcist. And he said, Bly adds, "Another common sign of possession is strength beyond their normal condition." And so those are some of the examples that I have in that chapter on the characteristics of violence related to spirit possession experience.
All right. Well, another category that you treat is strange speech. And as you make your way around the continents, as you just now did with the violent episodes, you mentioned in passing that possession and shamanic practices are not identical. So, I mean, when you read these anthropological accounts and when you study, you know, in other contexts, what kinds of distinctions are anthropologists looking for, and what kind of distinctions are you looking for between this kind of shamanic manifestation and another? What makes one shaman different from another shaman?
Yeah, so in anthropology, a shaman is typically capable of controlling the spirits. So what we would have here is not spirits that take control over the person and cause them to enact in negative ways or so on. But, you know, a shaman has an ability to, you know, utilize the spirit in order to communicate with the dead, speak with other spirits, and maybe ancestral spirits would be a big piece of this. But not having the possession experience that we would have in some of the other kind of things. So not necessarily utilized maybe as an instrument, like you would think of, like a person would still be in control. Sometimes shamanism, so this is where it gets a little tricky because not all culture is the same, right? And so sometimes in other cultural practices, shaman can become possessed by multiple spirits or through the use of multiple spirits. And so in each context or culture, you would really want to look into the context to see what's happening with the shaman there, you know, this use of the term. And that's where anthropology is really helpful to give some distinctions. So just because the shaman is using spirits does not indicate possession by the spirits would be the big piece that I was looking for. And to try to be fair to how each culture develops the conversation, I think is really important. To not just, you know, maybe read the New Testament account right into there. Oh, they have using a spirit, so they must be possessed. No, we can't do that. We need to be careful and to honor what each experience concludes about their experience.
And another question occurs to me that I really should have written in the notes, and I'm kicking myself for failing to do this, but I don't even know what language family the word shaman comes from, but a follow-up question I'd like to ask beyond that is, when we look at shamanic narratives, for instance, from Central Africa versus shamanic narratives from South Asia or Southeast Asia. I mean, first of all, whose word are we using? Is that an Indian word? Is that somebody else's word? And then, you know, those accounts, I mean, you know, do they emphasize different techniques that the shaman uses? Do they emphasize different results? Are there strong regional differences, or is there more common ground than there are differences?
I think the common ground is really that the shaman would typically not be possessed. Typically not, but sometimes can be. So that would be like the larger thing. Now, the where does the word come from? I will humbly admit to you, I do not know.
I don't know either. I should have looked that up when I was researching for the show. Because, you know, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I'm always interested in, for instance, when we talk about Native American tribes, I try to be very aware that we're using a Roman word to name North American realities, right? I'm curious to know. And I'll look it up after the show. Maybe I'll put it in the show notes. What language
That's
group originated this word shaman? Because it seems like we are taking somebody's word and using it to describe other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. And so listeners, I'll go ahead and say this is not Dr. Vaughn's fault. This is my fault. I should have looked that up before we started. But it just now occurred to me. I want to turn to...
At least if you know I don't know, I will tell you.
There you go. One passage I definitely learned about when I read your book is Acts 16, where Paul exorcises a person whose possessing spirit gives her powers of knowledge. So you note that the Greek text doesn't use the word prophetes here, you know, the word that certainly occurs in Homer. It occurs in other Greek texts, but instead it uses the Python word. So talk for a minute about the differences between those vocabularies and why the connection between Acts 16 and Delphi is important for understanding that story.
So she's possessed by the spirit of the Python. The Python is spirit in this particular text. And then the word describing her activity is a hapax legomena that is, you know, obviously different from what would mean to prophesy. And so the hapax legomena there has a pejorative kind of tone to it. So her speech in the eyes of Luke doesn't seem to be considered to be favorable. But to go a little bit back, to back up a little bit, the Python spirit was known to possess the Pythia, right, which is the priestess of Apollo at Delphi. And the Pythia would then, after being possessed, would give prophecy and participate in things like soothsaying, fortune telling. She would do this during her possession state. Now, there's a kind of a debate in scholarship about, is she experiencing an altered state of consciousness, or, you know, does her volume change? Does her voice change? So some of that's a fascinating conversation. If you read the book, I did put a little bit of that in there. And so if from the pagan perspective, if you were reading this, say, as an outsider to the Christian faith, and you're reading like she's possessed by this Pythian, this Python spirit, you're like, oh, good. You know, this could be really for her benefit. And I think maybe Luke sets up some surprise here that this spirit is exercised. Right. So from the Christian perspective, this is not going to work out. So using a more pejorative kind of term in the Greek to represent her activity. And if you look up the contemporaneous usage of that word, manta omine, it describes it as fortune telling, soothsaying, an intermediate agent who inspires oracular activity. And even the idea that the spirit speaks through the woman like a ventriloquist would. The activity is illicit and her exorcism is required. And so now I really wish this story would have told the fate of the woman after. What happens to her after this you know, event goes on, and we don't get that. And so that's kind of, sometimes if you ever feel a little disappointing, it's really only because you want more to the story. And so that background in Luke's vocabulary choice, I think, helps to understand that particular story a little bit better.
That's good. Because I would have assumed, but I'd never done any detailed study of that episode, that it would have been the same vocabulary that you get for Calchas in the Iliad or Tiresias in the, Antigone. It's a completely different vocabulary that the author of Luke Acts is using there.
Yeah.
Well, as we draw near to the end of our recording, I do want to pose a question about the end of the book. You make a passing reference to Walter Wink, who 25 years ago set the stage for my own readings of the New Testament spirit passages. You present him as a demythologizer. So, I mean, that's the same word that you use for Boltman. I'm doing more vocabulary study here, sorry. But you don't comment much else about Walter Wink, and that's all right. This is not a book about Walter Wink. I don't want to enter into an extended conversation about Wink, but I would like to hear you comment on this. As we go forward and as we think about not only biblical stories of spirit encounters, but also the ones that are occurring in our own moment in places that are not Europe, North America, and East Asian urban centers, how could we describe the spiritual and the political and their interaction in ways that avoid this demythologizing tendency?
Yeah, so when I thought it, think of, so at the end of the book, and this was actually, this book is published by Baylor University Press, and it was their idea that I give some reflections even on the nature of what is considered to be spiritual warfare. So we would have various perspectives on what that is. And in my best understanding of Walter Wink, which I, you know, really appreciate and respect his writings, it helpfully does, you know, he really helpfully does participate in allowing for the analogies to be compared and contrasted. And he really resists reductionistic interpretations in some way. But when it boils down to the conversation around spiritual warfare, it kind of, and maybe I'm splitting hairs a little bit here. So that spiritual warfare is fighting oppressive institutions rather than the demonic influence behind oppressive institutions. And so we might ask, you know, why is this institution? And we have plenty of oppressive institutions in our world today. You know, what is it? Is it simply social justice that we're really aiming for? I think is a really good thing. To fight for that and to fight against institutions that would oppress. However, I'm also thinking about, is there another kingdom that is also at work and at play that is actually not simply institutional forces? Is there a spiritual force that is also at play? And so that passive, I don't know if I would write it quite that way after you were picking at that. You know, again, I think it probably does require a bit more explanation. But, you know, it could be tending to be dismissive, you know, when Jesus says, my kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. You know, there's an implication that there are worldly kingdoms, but I think we also see in another kingdom, an enemy that is really set against us. And when I think about the spiritual warfare too, I often, you know, we're not fighting against humans per se. Because humans, no matter where they are in relationship to God, are made in God's image. And, you know, I don't like to perceive of them as the ultimate enemy. They are, you know, the God's image has been broken, and they are persons which I would like to see God's image restored. And so that was the context of that comment, if that makes sense. I hope that makes sense.
Well, that makes good sense. And again, I haven't paid sustained attention to Walter Wink, like I said, since the late 1990s. Okay. So my memories of him might be shaped by the ensuing 25 years of reading and teaching and studying. I'll confess. But sure. I suppose I saw his approach not as a separation between institutional and spiritual, but to talk about a different mode of involvement between those two. But that said, noted, it's been 25 years, so you might be getting the Gil Wink rather than the Walter Wink. So I'll just go ahead and say that my memory might be at fault here. So this is good. This is good.
That's okay. And you can double check mine too.
Very good. Very good. Well, Dr. Vaughn, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation. So in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word here at the end. What do you want our listeners thinking about? Spirit stories, exorcisms, the New Testament, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Thanks. By the way, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on the show today. It's been a really great time. One of the big takeaways of my book, and it was one of the reasons that piqued interest, was, you know, it has been important in many conversations to allow multicultural voices to have a place at the table to speak. And that is really what this book begs for. Would we be willing to allow the experiences of the lived reality of 74% of global societies begin to bear a seat at the interpretive table of these kinds of experiences. And so I know there are a lot of interpretations, and I'm favorable. There are medical, there are psychological, there are anthropological, there are sociological. But for much of New Testament scholarship in the West, the spiritual interpretation that is given in these stories, I kind of imagine like an executive style chair table, and that seat is just not present, or is not allowed to be a part of the story. And so the heart behind my book wasn't to say that you even need to believe that spirits are real or that can cause these things, but a lot of other people do. And when you silence her voice, you silence the lived realities of many, many people. And so that was just to think about that kind of piece, that we have a lot of these experiences that do take place. And so, would you allow a spiritual interpretation to be at the table? And so, interesting, one time I was thinking about, so often we dismiss the evil spirit stories, but we also have the Holy Spirit more accepting of this kind of spiritual story than this kind of spiritual story. And, how does this play out in our hermeneutics and how we think about scripture?
Vaughn, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles. Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Phenomenal Phenomena from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.